Lots of politicos talk about increasing voter turnout, but how? Could automatic registration be the answer?
We should be very concerned with why fewer and fewer people are participating in the decisions that determine everything about how we live, how we do business, what our rights are, and so forth.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, Arizona's new minimum wage law is back in court this afternoon. Why some nonprofits are conflicted by the measure. What's different in the newly adopted student math and English standards. Why fugitive governors from Mexico are ending up in Arizona. And making state government more accessible to the hearing impaired.
Sometimes I cannot hear at all what my colleagues or the presiding officers are saying. So that's pretty limiting.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today, we're looking for partly to mostly sunny skies and a high around 70 degrees. And then for tonight, should be clear and cool with lows in the mid-40s, sunny tomorrow with a high of 69. Currently partly cloudy skies and 66 degrees at KJZZ. A suspect involved in an overnight shooting that shut down Interstate 17 remains in serious condition. As KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, the highway was closed in that area for more than 11 hours as police investigated.
Police responded to a collision on the southbound lane of the 17 near Thomas Road Monday evening around 6:30 p.m. Department of Public Safety troopers at the scene reported a suspect had attempted to steal multiple cars at gunpoint. After allegedly kidnapping a 22-year-old man and demanding he drive him to Mexico, the suspect attempted to steal three more vehicles and shot two additional victims. Two DPS troopers shot the suspect after reportedly seeing him point his gun at officers and passing motorists. The suspect is only being identified as a 31-year-old male and is expected to live. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Phil Latzman.
And there is some positive news for Valley homeowners today, Steve.
But maybe not if you're in the market to buy a home.
The latest S&P Case-Shiller Price Index of the top 20 U.S. cities shows home prices up more than 5% in October, figures that are reflected here in the Phoenix area. And joining us now is David Blitzer. He is Managing Director and Chairman of the committee that produces these market indices each month. So how's it looking in our part of the world?
Phoenix continues to come back. Over the last year, prices are up 5.2%. They've been running at about that pace since early 2016. And I guess it's a welcome shift compared to Phoenix 10 or 12 years ago, when it was one of the three or four cities that showed some of the biggest declines and so on. But it seems to be solidly recovering and pretty much keeping pace with the national index, certainly not lagging behind the national index at all. The only sort of negative thing to say is that they're still about 28% below the peak that was reached back in 2006. So if getting past the old peak means something, unfortunately, it's going to be a few more years.
What the other metropolitan areas that are in the Case-Shiller Index look like, they have sort of gotten back to that peak, whereas here in the Phoenix area, we haven't quite gotten there?
Some have gotten back to the peak. About seven, Denver is the one that has done the best compared to its previous performance. And Dallas, Texas has also done very well compared to its previous performance. But both those cities compared to Phoenix had much smaller drops. And, you know, part of the question of setting a new peak is how far down did you go when you went down? And Phoenix and Las Vegas fell as much or more than any other city, and Las Vegas has still got about 35% to go up before it gets to creates a new peak. So the picture right now certainly looks very different. The picture right now is pretty much keeping pace with home prices nationally, and which puts you sort of in the middle of the pack in terms of how well you're doing.
And what is it to portend for 2017 as far as the real estate market here? Are we headed for another bubble in markets like this where there's a lot of vacation homes, people coming in from out of town? Does that make it a more vulnerable market for real estate?
In general, second homes or vacation homes are are more vulnerable. If people are going to be concerned about their finances, you know, the vacation home is something they'll pass on for the time being because it's a lot of money, and it's hard to argue it's an absolute necessity. But I think looking at the current trends, if a bubble means it's going to be followed by a crash, I don't think we're in a bubble. What I think we're seeing is home prices in Phoenix and nationally rising a good bit faster than the rate of inflation, and also rising faster than incomes are going up. And over the long haul, home prices aren't going to rise faster than incomes, because otherwise everybody's going to get priced out of the market. So I think home price gains will ease back, but I don't see a crash. What I think is 2, 3, 4 years from now, looking back, you'll see that home prices go down to roughly the rate of inflation, which is now a touch under 2%. And that's really the long-term pattern of home prices.
Mr. Blitzer, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Have a good day.
David Blitzer is Managing Director and Chairman of the S&P's Case-Shiller Price Index Committee. And Steve, another thing that will factor into these prices leveling off is the expected continued rise of interest rates, also volatile in a market like this, but eventually good news for prospective buyers who might feel like they're getting priced out of the market.
KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Phil, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Our next story is about the growing number of students who are enrolling in charter schools in our state.
According to the Arizona Department of Education, 180,000 students currently attend Arizona's 547 charter schools. That's an increase of 8,000 students in the last year.
At the same time, district school enrollment has stayed about the same. But this shouldn't come as a surprise, according to Dan Hunting, senior policy analyst at the Morrison Institute for Public Policy at Arizona State University.
Arizona's been a leader in the school choice movement for decades. We have the highest percentage of students in charter schools in this state.
But he says it's a mistake to directly compare charter schools and district schools.
The thing that I think is important to remember when looking at the school choice movement is that that was done years ago because we felt that there was not a one-size-fits-all model for education. Back in the day when essentially everybody went to the local school, that was kind of the model. We thought that everyone should go to those schools. Starting a couple of decades ago in Arizona, we thought, well, no, we need to give people choice, let people go where they want to. So sort of by definition, people are sorting themselves into different school systems. And so it's even a mistake to look at charter schools as a monolithic entity. There are certainly many charter schools that do very well academically. There are others that do not do so well. Some of the charter schools, the high school level especially, you have these very high-achieving schools that send essentially all of their students to college, and that's a wonderful thing. You also have these schools that are credit recovery schools. A lot of them are online. They're serving a population that may have dropped out of the traditional district high schools, and they obviously do not do quite so well.
So with a state funding crisis in Arizona's education system for the last several years, what does that mean for growing charter schools? According to the State Charter Schools Association, budget cuts continue to undermine charter schools. And according to Hunting, they get more than double the funding that district schools do per pupil from the state.
District schools get about half of their funding from local property taxes. The charter schools get essentially no funding from local funding. They can't impose property taxes the way a school district can. They get a little bit less in federal funding on average, but they actually get more than double the funding per pupil from the state.
And what does this growth mean for students? Hunting says that's up for interpretation, but he thinks we're starting to create two distinct systems, a charter system and a district system.
Those are different. And whether that difference is good or bad is sort of a matter of your own opinion. There's going to be inequities there. Charter schools are whiter than district schools. Charter schools serve a lower percentage of English language learners. They serve a lower percentage of people that are on what are called IEPs, individual education plans. So those are students that have some difficulty in schools. They also serve a lower percentage of people on the free and reduced lunch program, which is an indicator for poverty.
Hunting also says that a parent simply choosing to send their child to a high-achieving charter school isn't always as easy as it sounds. He says a lot of parents can drive their kids 20 minutes every day to a charter school and rearrange their work schedule to do it, but not all of them can.
If you are working a retail sales job, if you're in the restaurant industry where your shift changes every 2 weeks depending upon what the boss posts on the work schedule board, you probably cannot commit to that kind of thing. If you are a low-income parent that has unreliable transportation, cannot commit to doing that kind of commute on a daily basis. You're basically going to be stuck in your local district school. So it's possible that what we will end up having eventually is a system where the district schools are there for people who simply cannot make a choice to go elsewhere.
But, he says, even though Arizona's district schools are 49th in the nation in terms of per-student funding, they're doing pretty well.
Our district schools are still doing a pretty good job considering the situation that they're in. Our test scores are going up. Our graduation rates are good. Our college-going rates are pretty good. We may not have the district schools that are sending literally 100% of their students onto college, but we're sending a very good percentage. I think we've got a lot of teachers that are very committed to the profession and are doing a good job under some difficult circumstances.
That's Dan Hunting, senior policy analyst at the Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU. Long-term education funding is set to be a central issue again in the state legislature next session, and that session kicks off in just a few weeks. And coming up on the show, there are 8,000 open cybersecurity jobs in Maricopa County and not enough people to fill them.
Good Tuesday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve along with Lauren. In Valley traffic, I-10 eastbound at 75th Avenue causing a little bit of a backup. Valley weather for the rest of today, we should stay partly to mostly sunny, slightly above normal temperatures around 70 degrees. And for tomorrow, we should clear out nicely with lows in the mid-40s. For tomorrow, sunny with a high of 69, a little bit warmer for Thursday, and then by Friday, a slight chance for showers and highs in the upper 60s. Currently, relative humidity is at 29%. We've got some high thin clouds, and it's 66 degrees at KJZZ at 216.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony. The 8th Bösendorfer USASU competition finals return. Hear the passion and virtuosity of the three international finalists as they perform live with the Phoenix Symphony January 8th. Info at phoenixsymphony.org.
It's the show, and with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick. I'm Steve Goldstein.
Well, 2016 is the year that just won't give up. We've learned today that actress Carrie Fisher has died. You'll best know and remember Fisher for her iconic role as the gutsy Princess Leia of Alderaan from Star Wars.
What the hell are you doing?
Somebody has to save our skins. Into the garbage chute, flyboy.
Carrie Fisher was flying from London to Los Angeles last Friday when she went into cardiac arrest. Today, her family spokesman confirms that the actress and writer has passed away at just 60 years old. With me on the line now is Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Welcome, Rafer.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, the Carrie Fisher story, of course, includes Star Wars, without a doubt, but also an author, a novelist, screenplay artist. She's been in dozens of movies. What's the legacy here?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I think, she started out, obviously, as Princess Leia in Star Wars. You know, the white virginal robe, the crush for many an adolescent for many generations. But she also gave Princess Leia kind of a little edge, a little bit of snark and a certain kind of pluck that we hadn't seen before.
I don't know who you are or where you came from, but from now on, you do as I tell you, okay?
And that was her. That is really who Carrie Fisher turned out to be. I mean, you see her on talk shows, on television appearances. She was kind of a raconteur. You know, she was a real personality. She would talk about this famous upbringing she had, stories from the set. You know, recently she talked about, wrote about the affair she had with Harrison Ford on the set of the original Star Wars. And she was just one of these, almost like an Orson Welles type, a figure from the movie industry who was just a pleasure to listen to and just to hear her talk.
And if people don't remember, her mother was Debbie Reynolds, a huge star from the previous generation. Carrie Fisher really grew up in that soup.
Yeah, and she seemed to have, you know, kind of a love-hate relationship with it. You always got the sense that she found the whole thing a little silly, a little frivolous, a little stupid, and yet she couldn't leave it, and it treated her well. You know, as you said, she was a working screenwriter in Hollywood, a very well-known script doctor who worked on comedies, and, you know, it did well by her, and somehow you always got the feeling there was a little bit of a push-pull, but she always decided to stay, I guess.
And she always seemed like somebody who was supremely unapologetic, open about her alcoholism, open about her struggle with drug addiction, open about some of the more, you know, alienating aspects of being typecast or being a celebrity in American culture. She just kind of laid it all out there.
I think that was one of the things that we all liked about her, was because you knew that even though she would be gracious, as she always was to fans who, you know, had never-ending questions about Star Wars, that she would also never really pull any punches, and that you could always depend on her for kind of a good one-liner, a good zinger about Hollywood.
And she also managed to process the whole Princess Leia experience, the character, its impact on the culture, into a feminist narrative that was her very own, because she was already a star.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the fact that she plays a general, that she'd risen through the ranks to become a general in this last Star Wars film, really pleased people, and that really fit her character. And I, you know, when I saw it at an early screening and she appeared, you know, in the film, I mean, she got one of the biggest cheers of any character. People were so thrilled. They were so happy to see her. And I think that's a testament to the personality that she had and the personality that she brought to that character.
Author, novelist, actress, and artist Carrie Fisher, dead at 60. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks, Rafer.
Thanks, Todd.
And that's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway.
Religious secrets can have a very broad definition, and every religion has them. Some are related to its creation, others to things more difficult to describe. This month, Ryan McKnight, a former member of the Mormon Church, decided to give everyone the opportunity to learn about LDS secrets through launching the website MormonWikiLeaks.com. McKnight became nationally known in October through his YouTube posts, featuring inside conversations involving senior church officials. We connected with McKnight to find out about his goals for the site and his current relationship with the concept of religious faith. So, Ryan, has the Mormon religion been a part of your life from an early age?
Well, I was born into the church and raised as an active Mormon. I served a 2-year mission, and I was married in the Mormon temple, lived as an active Mormon until I was 32. About 3.5 years ago, I basically kind of came across some, in studying church history, you know, a narrative that didn't match up with the narrative I had been taught my whole life. And that caused me to sort of study that further, and led me to have to reevaluate my beliefs, my religious beliefs, my faith, and et cetera, et cetera. And ultimately led to me coming to the conclusion that that my beliefs were not in line with the Mormon Church.
A phrase we'll often hear is crisis of faith, and for some people that can be more ethereal. For some people, it's more at the ground level. Would you describe what you went through as that?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's definitely a lot of mental anguish that goes through one's mind. Yeah, it's kind of like you're basically going through the cycles of grief when you lose a loved one. You know, there's denial, there's anger, there's bitterness. You have to go through all those feelings, and I definitely felt those very hard. I'd say for the first, you know, six to 10 months, but you know, it does go away with time.
Well, and you've chosen, I mean, this is something where people who have crises of faith will sometimes just decide, okay, I'm going to leave this faith. I'm going to see how it affects myself and my family life. You've taken a much bigger step than that.
Yeah, I mean, well, the main goal of the website is transparency, pure and simple. And, you know, I didn't set out 3.5 years ago to be, you know, standing here talking to you today about this website. I kind of accidentally kind of fell into this world of leaking documents, stemming back to the what has been dubbed the November policy leak last year, which I had a small role in. But it kind of ended up putting me as a kind of a point man online, as somebody that people can come to, and people would come to me every once in a while. Most of the time, it wasn't really anything newsworthy, but you know, I did release some things here and there that people would send me, and then that kind of culminated with these videos that I released back in October. Then I began to really get inundated with people contacting me, employees, and they would share some things with me that I also leaked out there. But again, nothing that was like really super newsworthy. But a lot of what I noticed throughout the last year is that some people that have some things that they want to get out there, they're apprehensive because of anonymity, issues with anonymity. And about 6 months ago, before the videos, I had kind of had this idea of having this type of a website. But after the attention that the videos got, and I kind of stepped up the effort and I put together a team. We worked really hard for the last 2.5 months to get this up there. It's just more information that maybe the public, you know, at least the stakeholders of the church, you know, the tithe payers, should know, and it just makes them more informed about the organization that they support. And it doesn't have to be a negative thing.
And it seems to be something that could apply to those who are still in the church or outside the church, or do you expect those who are in the church to think it could be something that they shouldn't be looking at?
Yeah, there's probably going to be that. I mean, I know I was that way when I was an active member. I was very hesitant to read things online and trust things online. So there's always going to be that. But I think that attitude is somewhat changing. And I think there's a lot of Mormons that are less and less afraid of hearing something that might potentially be negative. You know, they've found ways to sort of rationalize it and maintain their faith. So, you know, the more information, the better. You know, I don't think that active Mormons should be afraid of whatever comes out of this website. I mean, it is what it is. Whatever comes out is what it is.
Is Mormonism still, to many people, sort of something different that they don't understand?
Yeah, absolutely. And that has been magnified in my life as I have been, you know, openly a non-believer. I think non-Mormon friends of mine have actually opened up in that regard to me, where before they were sort of more taking a polite road and not wanting to say things, but they've opened up about how, you know, weird things seem to them, or how weird things have always seemed to them. And they're always intrigued to hear about my experiences in Mormonism and my experience leaving the church. They eat that information up. So I definitely think that there is a lot of interest in non-Mormons about the Mormon church. And a lot of that has to do with the secrecy, you know, with the lack of transparency. You have this huge, powerful, wealthy organization that nobody really knows about how the inner workings are.
How is your relationship with your family, with friends, and how do you feel about yourself as a person of any sort of spiritual background?
Well, I'd rather not make any comments about my family, but you know, I will say that I have lost almost all of my Mormon friends when I left the church, and that was before I had ever done anything vocally online. Just for the fact that I left the church, people stopped communicating with me. So, you know, that's definitely a difficult thing to go through. You know, when I first kind of gravitated away from Mormonism, I still was maintaining a belief in God. But just as I critically investigated Mormonism for the first time, I also began to critically investigate God for the first time. And a couple months later after that, I kind of went away from a hard belief in that. I would probably identify today as an atheist, but not in the sense that I say there is no God, but I just think that there's no evidence that there is one. I'm always open to additional new information.
Ryan McKnight is the founder of MormonWikiLeaks.com. So how does the creation of Mormon WikiLeaks fit into the greater history of private information about the Mormon Church being released? With me to talk about that is Alexandria Griffin, a PhD student in Mormon Studies at ASU. Alexandria, how common is this kind of thing, and how does the technology behind Mormon WikiLeaks advance or change that?
Leaving Mormonism or seeing it from a distance and feeling that they need to warn others in some capacity goes back essentially to the religion's beginning. One very famous early example is that of Annalisa Young, who was one of Brigham Young's wives, who left Mormonism and polygamy and published an expose called Wife Number 19 that was intended to warn other Americans about the horrifying dangers, right, of Mormonism and polygamy. All through Mormon history, you have similar examples. I think what's really interesting about the Mormon WikiLeaks website is that, I mean, first, it's a very 21st century approach, right? Even 10 or 15 years ago, even if there had been a similar website, the general concept of you can drop off these secret documents in a secure place, that's relatively new, right?
How important is it that the information that people find out about is earth-shaking, or just that this is transparency? We should know what is going on and what plans these big leaders are making.
What'll kind of determine whether it becomes, whether the website really becomes a thing, right? Or whether it becomes just kind of a footnote in the history of people discussing Mormonism is what he gets, right? So potentially if something really big, like for example, new policies around children of same-sex marriages and things like that, I think if you were to get something like that, that would definitely kind of maintain the profile of that site. I feel like already in terms of people talking about things around Mormonism, already I think I've been seeing a lot more chatter about the Mormon Tabernacle Choir playing at Trump's inauguration, right? Because that news came out not long after the announcement of the website. And so I think in some ways it very much remains to be seen.
So is there a different layer of mystery to the religion than to outsiders? I'm even thinking when Mitt Romney was the Republican nominee, that seemed to, people still were wondering about him, but it did seem to make it a little bit more mainstream.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people have referred to the quote unquote Mormon moment, which kind of usually is identified as coalescing around Romney's two campaigns, as well as the release of, for example, the Book of Mormon musical, kind of this sudden broad visibility of Mormons in popular culture. One of the big things for Romney, I feel like, especially in 2008, was whether evangelicals would be willing to get behind a Mormon. I mean, the LDS Church itself, and I think most everyday Mormons would consider themselves Christian, but because they don't have quite the same kind of Nicene, the creedal conception of God and things like that, of the Trinity, right? So God and Heavenly Father and Jesus and the Holy Spirit in Mormonism are three separate beings, which is completely baffling to many other forms of Christianity. So due to things like that, and again, kind of the charge of secrecy or the idea of temples, there was a lot of question definitely about whether evangelicals or other groups that are kind of traditionally expected to vote Republican, whether they would get behind Romney. And so you did see a lot more discussion about Mormonism. I feel like there was kind of a broader effort to discuss, again, to kind of talk about temple stuff as not kind of some malicious secret that was being withheld, but just as, you know, kind of a thing that's associated with kind of the sacred sphere, if you will. I think it still maybe remains to be seen how much that entire kind of era did or didn't demystify Mormons for the broader public.
Alexandria Griffin is a PhD student in Mormon studies at ASU, and we've been talking about the possible impact of the new website, MormonWikiLeaks.com. Some of European literature's classics survive today in high school and college classrooms, but beyond those walls, not much attention is paid to them. Recently, though, the ASU libraries acquired 36 books that have been owned by Phoenix businessman Robert A. Lawler. The university and English professor Richard Neuhauser are excited about the volumes, the earliest of which is from 1550, and Richard Neuhauser is with me to give us some more details. Richard, who are some of the well-known names in this collection?
We have Geoffrey Chaucer, Walter Raleigh, Francis Bacon, Ben Jonson, Shakespeare, and Milton.
So how important a role does Chaucer play then? People think of Chaucer with the Canterbury Tales, of course.
What's so important is that we have some of the earliest editions of Chaucer. A 1550 edition by Tyne of Chaucer's complete works, or what he thought was his complete works. Mm-hmm. And they really do let us see not only how people were reading and that they were reading Chaucer, but what kinds of extra texts they thought belonged to Chaucer.
When it comes to the modern key, and even someone who perhaps is not an English major, how does this blend into modern education now?
First of all, we have to realize that we have here artifacts, and just as we can see that there's a sense for a museum not to just assemble pictures of artifacts, but the artifacts themselves, so it's important to have these texts in the library. And let me elucidate three reasons for this. These volumes bring century-old texts to life. And that is to say that it makes it possible for us to engage the past with more of our senses than simply the visual sense. We're not just looking at these books, We're holding them in our hands. We are feeling the texture of the pages as we turn them. We are smelling the books. And secondly, these volumes are living documents, and they show not only what the past found worthy of being in print, they also demonstrate how the readers of the books reacted to the text, because a number of the volumes contain glossing, that is to say, marginal comments by readers over the centuries. Third, we may or we may not learn from the past about how to avoid the mistakes in the present, as the common saying goes. But the texts from the past do reveal to us possibilities that we might not know about otherwise.
How does literature like this help us in any way deal with our changing diverse population? Because I think people will make they'll at least stereotype it and say, well, in that time, there was not this sort of diversity. So how can they teach us something with that?
You know, I can point to one of the Canterbury Tales, which is clearly an anti-Semitic tale, and it demonstrates some of the aspects of anti-Semitism. The Prioress's Tale, written at a time when there were no large communities of Jews in England, yet speaks to an inherited, transmitted racist feeling that can show us that the presence of an object of racism may not have anything to do with the reality of what that and many times has nothing to do with the reality of that person or that group of people, but is rather related to a sense of transmitted ideas about that person or about that group.
At what point does this literature cease to become important to society?
I would say that the possibilities of all of this kind of literature, this pre-modern literature becoming irrelevant to society, will happen when hell freezes over.
Richard Neuhauser is a professor of English and Medieval Studies at ASU.
Coming up on the show, a local dance workshop where no one's feet touch the ground. That's next.
Good Tuesday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. Along with Lauren Gilger, I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today, partly to mostly sunny skies and a high temperature around 70 degrees. Then for tonight, we should be clear and cool with lows in the mid-40s. For tomorrow, sunny skies, dry conditions, a high of 69. And then it'll be mostly sunny on Thursday with a high expected to reach 71. Currently with relative humidity at 30%, we're at 66 degrees at KJZZ. In a quick check of traffic, an accident to avoid on I-10 eastbound at 67th Avenue, blocking the right lanes. It's 2:36.
Business reporting is made possible in part with support of Beach Fleischman, an Arizona-based CPA firm.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. 75 years after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, President Obama and Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe today are visiting the memorial set on the waters above the sunken USS Arizona. Earlier in Honolulu, speaking through a translator, Abe said his visit to the memorial is meant to send a message of goodwill to the United States.
I am very much looking forward to sending out a strong message on the value of the reconciliation as well as our sincere pray for the souls of the war dead.
6 months ago, Barack Obama became the first sitting U.S. president to visit Hiroshima in Japan, where the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb in hopes of ending World War II. Crews are scrambling to restore power in the northern plains. As the day began, there were outages from Montana to the Dakotas and in Michigan. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
It stopped snowing in South Dakota, but the governor's declared a state of emergency. Brenda Klein and John with the South Dakota Rural Electric Association says utility crews are struggling to reach outages spanning nearly half the state.
It is a mess. Our crews have been out working it since the beginning of Christmas Day.
and making what progress they can.
Klein & John says her customers are spaced nearly a half mile apart on average. Wind, snow, and ice brought down many of the power lines connecting them. As of Tuesday morning, more than 13,000 South Dakota homes and businesses were still off the grid. Klein & John says customers are using generators, wood stoves, and temporary heaters to get by. Utility crews from out of state are joining the work, but Klein & John says it'll take, at best, several days to restore power across South Dakota. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
On Wall Street at the close, the Dow closed up 11 at 19,945. The NASDAQ was up 24. This is NPR.
In KJZZ News at 2:38, a naval ship named for former Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords is set to be commissioned. As KJZZ's Catherine Fritke reports, the $475 million ship is being handed over to the Navy later this week.
The USS Gabrielle Giffords has completed testing in the Gulf of Mexico and will be commissioned in mid-2017. It will be the ninth in a series of high-speed vessels designed to navigate in shallow coastal regions. Giffords helped christen the 421-foot-long ship in 2015. The Navy says they chose to name the ship in honor of Giffords because of the perseverance she showed after being shot in the head in 2011. The naval program the USS Giffords is part of has become a target for critics. Some members of Congress have slammed it as flawed and too expensive, but Navy leaders defend it as a critical new step in naval warfighting. Catherine Fricke, KJZZ News.
Across the country, there are about 350,000 open cybersecurity jobs that need people to fill them. It's a growing field, and there aren't enough people trained to do the job. That's according to John Haas, director of the Cyber Intelligence and Security Program at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. I reached Haas at Embry-Riddle's campus in Prescott, and he told me cybersecurity experts who've been in the field for decades are retiring, and at the same time, the demand for them is growing.
Every company of every type in all of the different industries are requiring cybersecurity today, because whether you're PetSmart or Safeway, or you're a financial institution such as Charles Schwab, you need to be able to secure people's data, your payments, and all of your financials in the back room.
So how can we fill those jobs? Haas is part of the Arizona Statewide Cyber Workforce Consortium, which is put together by Chicanos por la Causa and Cybersecurity Canyon to create a pipeline of talent here in Arizona. And when I spoke with him, I asked him if this shortage was prompted by Embry-Riddle to start this program 4 years ago.
We knew it was a problem back then. We just didn't know the magnitude of the problem. And it became apparent when, about that same time, the government said that they wanted to start hiring cyber people for the military. And at that time, they said, where are we going to find 10,000 trained people? And we foresaw that because just two years before, the president had said this is an important area for our national defense.
So this came to light at a federal level.
It came to light at a federal level, and then at that time, what happened is that we identified 16 critical sectors. These are the different types of companies that if they were to go wrong, it would mean that the country would be in trouble. For instance, water and power, transportation, retail, finance, insurance. These sectors are critical to our economy. And the government realized we can't protect these companies. We have to teach them how to protect themselves. And I think that's when the company suddenly realized, oh, we're on our own. The feds aren't going to help us.
Right, right. You said all over the country, 350,000 jobs. What's the situation like here?
Almost 8,000 of them are right in Maricopa County.
So I want to dig into what's behind this problem a little bit. So do you think the public knows that this is an issue, that this is a good place to go find a job right now?
Well, they may not know that yet. They may just be seeing that it's in the news a lot. I do think it became more apparent to the general public when we had these problems. This summer, of course, we heard about it during the election campaign, when the Democratic National Committee was hacked and people were saying, maybe the Russians are after us. And perhaps that got people to think, I wonder if they really are. And companies are recognizing it because last year, the Security and Exchange Commission said, perhaps every company that's publicly traded should have somebody who's knowledgeable about cybersecurity on their board.
But do you think that's happened with most companies?
No, not yet, but it is starting to bubble up. You're starting to see articles that say, what should you be asking as a chairman of the board about your cybersecurity stance?
Are there just not enough programs like yours that teach cybersecurity around the country?
There aren't. Right now, if we were to graduate everyone from all of the programs all around the country, it still wouldn't be enough. So in the past, what they've done is they've taken people from computer science, they've taken people from engineering, from mathematics, and then they've trained them on the job to learn about cybersecurity. Whereas today, we realize it's good to actually train people right away so that they don't have to get retrained by companies.
That was John Haas, who started the Cyber Intelligence and Security Program at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott.
It's being dubbed the beginning of the timber age, where breakthroughs in super strong wood are seeing architects around the world design and build skyscrapers made entirely of timber. The BBC's Katie Silver reports on the latest bid to ensure sustainable buildings.
In the trendy northeast London suburb of Dalston, builders are putting the finishing touches on the world's largest timber housing development. It's a building with 121 apartments.
So the whole building, the whole structure of the building above the ground floor is made from solid timber, 1,930 tons of timber.
Andrew Waugh designed the building. He says despite the issue of deforestation, building with timber is better for the environment than other materials.
The production of concrete and steel produces over a third of the world's greenhouse gases. So by building a building from timber, which in essence is carbon, we are not only stopping that carbon being emitted, but we're actually storing it within the material of the building.
What's it going to be like for the people living in this place?
Fabulous. So I live in a solid timber house myself. I built with a couple of friends. We've got three flats in a row. And just living in these buildings is a really pleasurable experience.
From the northeast, I've now headed down to the Barbican near central London to meet someone else who has big, ambitious plans for timber.
People really enjoy living and working and going to school in timber environments, partly because they associate timber with the outdoors, with nature. It's shown that their stress levels are reduced by that means.
Kevin Flanagan of PLP Architecture designed a 984-foot skyscraper, which could be the latest bold addition to London's iconic skyline. Dubbed the Toothpick, it would be a sleek 80-storey tower made almost entirely of timber.
It would take about 120 minutes for us to grow as much timber in Europe that would be required, the 60,000 square metres of timber that would be required for this tower.
Kevin's numbers are based on the growth rate of forests in Europe and how much wood this tower would need to be built. While it's a feasibility study, other projects have become a reality. The tallest is Treet, Norwegian for tree, a 14-storey apartment block in Bergen in the country's southwest. The apartments were built in Estonia, shipped over, and then stacked on top of each other using a crane. Watching it be assembled is really quite spectacular. Rune Abrahamsen is the project's chief structural engineer.
We have experience constructing large wooden bridges. This building is basically using the same framework that we use in bridges, which is then raised vertically.
There are similar structures being built around the world, including in Melbourne, Vienna, Stockholm, and Vancouver. They're built using cross-laminated timber, where small sections of wood are crisscrossed over each other and glued to form large structural panels. The process makes the wood light, strong, and most importantly, more resistant to fire. Architect Andrew Waugh hopes timber can make brick and steel buildings a thing of the past.
This is really a revolutionary process. The future of construction has to be around timber. We have a housing crisis in the UK and worldwide. We need to build more homes. But we need to do that in a way which is not going to exacerbate the situation that we have with climate change.
The architect Andrew Waugh ending that report by the BBC's Kate Silver. Good Tuesday afternoon. This is the show on 91.5 with Lauren. I'm Steve. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. Checking Valley traffic at this hour, an accident to watch out for on I-10 eastbound at 67th Avenue. That's blocking a couple of the right lanes. And just a little bit west of that, I-10 eastbound at 75th Avenue, may find some confusion there. A traffic signal is on flash. Never want that. I-17 northbound, meanwhile, some moderate slowing for a couple of miles. That starts right around Indian School Road. Valley weather for the rest of today, we should be partly to mostly sunny, with a high temperature in the upper 60s. Then for tomorrow, mostly clear skies and lows in the mid-40s. Should be sunny tomorrow, again above normal, with a high of 69. Mostly sunny skies Thursday, with a high of 73. And then a slight chance for showers comes our way on Friday. Currently, relative humidity's at 30%. We have some high, thin clouds. Otherwise, it's mostly sunny. And we're at 66 degrees here at 91.5 at 249.
KJZZ is supported by Yupa's Thai Kitchen, located on the southeast corner of McClintock and Elliott in Tempe, serving authentic Thai food in a homeland-style decor. Lunch and dinner menus at yupas.com.
Picture a dance, whatever it is that comes to mind when you hear the word. Maybe it's a ballerina leaping, a group moving in synchronized choreography, or two people tangled in a tango. Whatever it is, they're probably using their feet, right? But at a recent dance workshop in Phoenix, most of the dancers' feet never even touch the ground. The show's Annika Klein takes us to the floor.
Leah LaFartha is dancing. The whirring sound that slides in and out of the music, that's her power chair zooming across the wood floor of the dance studio.
It's a process. You kind of have to relearn how to do everything.
When she started using the chair, LaFartha had to relearn how to move around her own home, how to get in and out of buildings with obstructions like stairs, and how to dance.
The chair is a tool, because without it, I would be hunched up and immobile.
Jolene Detage has branched out from her hobby of acting to give dance a try, and says for her, it takes the chair beyond just a practical tool.
As far as in dance, it's almost like an extension of yourself, and you're kind of moving with the wheelchair, and you're kind of using it as part of different dance scenarios.
And we're just going to explore, it starts really simply, light resistance. See what that feels like?
Allison Yoder is one of the facilitators of this three-hour workshop called Dance Mixability. She's a local dancer.
Being cognizant of the chair and the joystick. You can also explore.
Yoder does not use a wheelchair, but she guides the four wheelchair dancers and one able-bodied dancer through different exercises, always reminding them to translate movement in their own way.
So put the idea of it into your own body in whatever way that looks like for you.
Sometimes people just don't think that people in wheelchairs are able to dance.
Katie Griffith has been interested in inclusive dance classes for years, but says the dance classes she's tried to attend have been inconsistent. She's really hoping this workshop becomes a regular class she can take.
Just to be out there and be able to show people that just because I use a wheelchair doesn't define me is really something that makes me proud that I'm able to do that.
Wheelchair dancing itself is nothing new. In fact, many dance groups around the country bring in dancers of different body types to emphasize diversity, rather than hunting for dancers with the same body type.
I truly believe that every single person has a dancer inside of them already.
Marissa Hamamoto founded Infinite Flow. That's a wheelchair ballroom dance company in California. She's able-bodied, but recovering from a temporary paralyzation in 2006 led her to want to teach dancers with and without disabilities. She says the idea of dancing is kind of intimidating for people across the board.
There's tons of people that come to me saying, hey, I have two left feet. And I have a ton of people that come to me say, hey, I have two left wheels. What am I supposed to do?
And she says teaching them that, yes, they actually can dance is one and the same. She says she's noticed what holds wheelchair users back is not so much the chair,
but how people perceive them.
Pick it up!
Yoder has led Dance Mixability workshops a few times and plans to offer them more regularly next year. She wants participants to teach too, so she can learn from the dancers using wheelchairs.
Another area of interest for me is like, how do I adapt my body to the kinds of movements that people in chairs are able to do, like with the power chairs, the kind of like swooping, gliding.
At one point in the workshop, LaFartha makes a suggestion to try to mirror each other's movements in sweeping circles. And they really pick up speed in the chairs.
You guys are so gliding. I was like, how do I glide?
Turns out you can fit a lot of different movement into three-quarter time. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens. Bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens.
Brown paper packages tied up with strings.
These are a few of my favorite things.
2016 has been a really tough year for many people. So as the year draws to a close, we wanted to take a minute to celebrate a few things we loved from this year in a series called My Favorite Things. And joining me now is KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve. So I spoke with a local artist named Angela Ellsworth, and she is the founder and artistic director of the Museum of Walking, which has been around since 2014. And the museum is dedicated to the idea that walking itself is an art practice. So Angela Ellsworth and the other folks at the museum lead walks for community members all over the city. And I spoke with Angela about some of her favorite walks from this year and some of the most memorable experiences she had while walking. So she starts by explaining what going on a group walk, often with a bunch of strangers, is really like.
When I facilitate them, I basically just want people to just trust on arriving at a place, getting there, and then generally, I just say, okay, you know, we're going to go this far, will be about this many miles. And then I often have some object that makes a bell ring or clinks on metal. Sometimes it's a musical triangle and sometimes it's a singing bowl. And I let them know that at a few different parts of the walk that they'll hear the bell, and that is an indicator to just stop walking and just stand still and listen. There's something beautiful as we're walking that we hear each other's feet on the ground. While that's kind of wonderful and rhythmic, we also can forget about listening to the birds or listening to the leaves on the trees and other sounds in the environment. So that stopping is really important. And then when we finish the walk, I ring the bell one more time or clang the triangle, and then everyone just goes home. Some people stick around and talk, but a lot of people just go home. And so we've had this experience together in a way that we probably don't normally or regularly communicate with each other, people we know or don't know.
What does it feel like to be walking in silence with a group of people?
Oh, it's one of my best things, I think. As a culture, we're sort of indoctrinated to be talkers and what do you do? What's your name? Where are you from? Where do you live? Da, 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 da. And there's the initial meeting of someone is usually with some kind of language exchange. And that's has its place and it's great, but I think that can become sort of a habit of the way we communicate. So in being in the landscape in silence or just not talking, because actually what you realize is it's not silent at all. We just stop talking and so let other parts of our world be the sound. And, you know, being with a group of people, for instance, we had a silent walk right after the election, and it was planned for months ahead, and a lot of people after the election results started RSVPing for whatever reason. And then, you know, so we had like 50 people coming, and then I thought there were maybe 60, and it ended up that there were about 75 people under the full moon walking in silence. And it felt like it was a collective action. We were experiencing time and space and nature together in a new way. And you can feel the energy of people, especially being quiet. It's hard to be quiet sometimes. And when we can give ourselves permission to just settle down a little bit, slow down a little bit, and really listen, I think that some transformative things can happen on a communal level and on a personal level.
You walk all over the city. You lead walks, you walk with lots of people, you walk by yourself. What maybe was the, like, a new favorite walk that you found or that you came upon this year, or some, a walk that you did that felt really good to you, that really moved you?
Well, the walk at Pima Canyon that I just explained was really pretty powerful, I think. But one of my favorite walks this last year was a walk we did with a woman named Patty Talahongva. And this was a walk at Indian School Park. And she works for Native American Connections, which is an amazing organization. And she is in charge of raising money and saving some of the historic buildings that are left there at the park. Although it's a contentious history with those buildings, she also went to school there. She went to high school there. So it is also her memory. And so Patty took us on a walk around Steel Park, and she shared with us her memories of going to high school there and sharing with us where certain buildings used to be and now do not exist anymore. And what's so important about that walk to me is that there are a number of people who live in Arizona, who live in Phoenix, even downtown Phoenix or midtown Phoenix, who drive on Indian School Road and know nothing about where the name of that road came from.
Do you have any walks planned for 2017 that you're particularly excited about?
Yes. I'm so glad you asked, because we, the Museum of Walking, is planning one of our biggest walks. It's called The Walk, and the goal is to have 1,000 people walking in silence in the Rio Salado Restoration Habitat space.
Any wishes for 2017 that you want to communicate?
I want to encourage everyone to practice listening deeply and listening in ways that perhaps we haven't before.
That is Angela Ellsworth, founder and artistic director of the Museum of Walking.
And that's KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. We'll be talking with other community members about their favorite things from 2016 in the next week or so. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
And that's all for today's edition of the show on 91.5. Be sure to be with us tomorrow morning at 11 for KJZZ's Here and Now. We'll talk about 2016, look ahead to 2017, and revisit some of our favorite interviews. That's tomorrow morning at 11.
A lot going around here on the Valley tonight. You can see the Arizona Coyotes play the Dallas Stars tonight in at the Gila River Arena in Peoria. And you can also check out They Call Me Brooksy, a variety show tonight at Crescent Ballroom in downtown Phoenix. The show was produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Kaylee Monahan, Regina Revazova, Tiara Vian, and Blake Bernard. Jean-Claire Sarmiento works on the digital side. Our news director is Al Macias, and our executive producer is John Hoban.
For Lauren, I'm Steve. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix in HD. Thanks for listening. It's 3 o'clock.